Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Night Shadows. I'm Stuart Best. Where the paranormal is normal. Where that which you thought you knew, you didn't. And where the future can be known, if you know exactly where to look.
Well, good evening, everyone, and thanks for tuning in and listening. And we have a very important guest, Richard Chaw, is with us, and Larry. And before we get going on the show, though, I wanted to just remind everybody that the category of paranormal on Blog Talk Radio has been shifted over to a subdivision of hobbies. And I'm not sure exactly why that has happened, but anyway, evidently the paranormal is a hobby now and not paranormal. And the other thing I wanted to tell everybody about before we get going, YouTube has blocked out one of my documentaries called Daniel and the Four Beast Powers, which is an expose of the real truth behind Daniel 7 and the false teachings of many in the prophetic field, which we prove conclusively in that two-hour documentary. And they evidently took it down from what we can gather. We made a reference to the Masonic Lodge, and we excerpted in Fair Use Doctrine, which they probably haven't even heard of, a Masonic presentation that was done on PBS over 10 years ago or more. But anyway, they have now removed it, and nobody in America or Canada can now see that documentary. So just a warning what YouTube is about. And they're connected in, of course, with Google, and they're connected in with Facebook and Twitter. This is all deep state, CIA, NSA data collection. In fact, you might recall that the chief of the NSA was at that time, I think, a four-star general, I can't remember his name, came right out on television and said, we love Facebook, we love Twitter, we love all these because it makes our job so much easier collecting data. So they have been collecting data on all of you folks for years and years and years, and I think we're getting ready now for a big, big shift. Anyway, Richard, welcome to the show. Glad to have you on.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here. How are you guys?
Yeah, Larry, how are you doing up on your mountaintop?
I'm still sitting up here with a really big set of binoculars watching the world.
Well, where do we want to start? Why don't we start with Israel and the Bible codes that you I know Glazerson put some of them out. I saw them on YouTube. But
well, he sent me one this
morning.
I would
like to dig into that a little bit. Larry, you've got some of the words that we use, and I'm sure you do, Richard, as well. Where do you want to start with this?
Yeah, go ahead, Richard. I'll let you start. You know kind of where we're going.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've got a lot of – oh, my gosh, I've got so much material here. It's hard to know even where to start, but I did get a new Torah code from Rabbi Glazerson earlier this morning, and he will send me these codes and all of the interpretations of each of the words, and then what he asked me to do is do the English translations for him. So I do that. And it's time-consuming. I have to go into Photoshop, and I have to enlarge the tables, and I have to make them, you know, really crisp and clear, and then font around each of those words so people know what's in the tables. And it helps him when he does his demonstrations about that. But he found a table the other day, which was really fun. And I don't ask him to do this, but it was a Torah code table, and it had all of our names in it. Which was kind of cool. It had Eliyahu, you know, for Rips, and then it had Matityahu, which is Glazerson's first name, and then below all of those guys, it said Richard Chaw. So I said, I comically wrote him back, and I said, it looks like God has you guys at least on a first-name basis. So it's really intriguing to me, because some of the Torah codes are complete baloney, and they're not even real Hebrew words that some people are putting together because they don't really know the language that good. That's why I wouldn't attempt it, because I know I would probably screw it up. So
mm-hmm.
I'd rather have Glazerson do it, or Professor Rips, or Robert Herelick. And of course, when I do get the privilege of talking to any of those guys, I can always pretty much figure that they're going to give me the most accurate a translation of a word, if it's even a word at all. Some people are pulling up words that aren't words. So the tables, they could say it's significant, but it doesn't mean anything. So you have to be really, really careful about
mm-hmm.
that. But he gave me a table today about North and South Korea peace, which I sent to you, Stuart.
Yes, yes.
So you probably see that. I haven't even had time to post it on my website. It's just things are moving too quickly for me here. But, I don't have any staff. And this month has been, we're working on starting two really huge projects. But in the meantime, there's no money to live on. So we've been like, oh, great, it's April. It's tax month, so we have to put all this money out for tax. And we have no income right now. So it's just like crazy. So we're trying
mm-hmm.
to make ends meet until these other projects hit. But I have two really huge projects in the works, and it's actually pretty darned exciting. I'm just tired of waiting. I guess that's what I would say about that.
Yeah, it gets frustrating, doesn't it?
Tremendously so. So we're trying to, and it's hard because I don't want to be hawking products all the time. I really detest that, when you're just trying to get on a show and you want information, and then half the show, it's getting like Alex Jones, a third of his programming, or almost half of it is hawking his products, So it's like, I don't want to get to the point where I have to do something like that. But I think the interesting thing is there are people in this world that have incredible amounts of resources, and
yes,
they just need to know about the kind of projects that we're trying to do, and once they know about it, they're going to want to become involved. And I never want people to become involved financially with anything I'm doing unless they somehow benefit from it financially too,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
I otherwise it's just like the only time that I haven't done that was David Greenhill's Good Graces to get us started on the Torah Code film, which never would have happened if he hadn't donated the initial monies to get that film rolling. We had waited
mm-hmm.
for years to try to find someone to finance it, and he stepped up and wanted to do it. And I told him, I said, look, I have no PR on this. I have no money to promote this or anything like that, but I am trying to do it, and it seems a shame that we've waited so long, and I have all of these guys that will work on it with me. And so he was gracious enough to put the first funds in. So that's how the Torah Code film got done. But now I'm at a point where I'm wanting to do more network quality projects, including theatrical releases, because I'm tired of doing things that are so low budget that I can't hire the crew that I need or anything else. So I'm not complaining, but I'm just stating a fact that at a certain point, to make excellence, it costs money to do that. So we're trying to raise money to do it. But can I give you guys a progress report really quick on
sure.
what's happening with Watchers?
Sure.
Yeah. I know you guys are familiar with the Watchers series that L.A. Marzulli and I have been working on and recently completed. We put out a film called The Best of Watchers. It's a really nice collection of people's favorite moments from the series, and I didn't realize how many hours of footage we had till I had to add it up. recently, and we've got like over 16 hours of footage in Watchers, which includes the best of Watchers now. And for a lot of people, that's too much to even delve into. If you buy like the 11 DVD set for $99, which you can get from L.A. Marzulli's site, or you can go to my site, pinlight.com, and order it there for $99. It's really a really good value, and it's cheaper than almost of any of these other series for a series that large, you know. So you're getting a good deal, but a lot of people today don't have that kind of time to invest in it. So that's why we did the Best of Watchers. It's 2 hours and 23 minutes long, and it has 10 segments that are pretty much all of our favorites from the series. So I would highly recommend people pick that up, because I don't think they'll be disappointed with it. But I have just gotten some connections for broadcasting the entire Watcher series in China.
Oh, really?
Now, I have friends that are Chinese that I've known for many years, and her name's Fen, and I said, can you help me get the Watcher series on mainland China? Because I said, you know, I know that they like all of these topics in China, and I'd like to get it over there. So she was going to go to China back in October and take it with her. I gave her all the materials, and that didn't work out. So then just recently there was this big meeting she wanted me to come to, she said. And she named all of these executives that were Chinese that were going to be there. And as usual, I never know what she's talking about. she's a great friend. And I, you know, her English is a little broken, but I love her dearly. And I've known her at least 10 years, maybe a little longer than that. And she's someone that Barry Morrow introduced me to. Barry Morrow is the writer of Rain Man. And so she's a mutual friend of both of us. So I said, okay, I'll come to this meeting. And it was at this big studio, and they had a stage, and they had this gigantic monitor, and they had celebrations going on, and women all dressed up in Chinese outfits and beating drums and the whole – I mean, it was just, like, stunning. They put us on the second row to the front where the VIP sit. And then they took us out to dinner. This was basically a signing ceremony to bring television shows from the United States to China. And they had lawyers there, and they had legal people, and they were signing these documents on the stage and applauding and beating drums. And they had an announcer there with a haircut like Kim Jong-un. It was hilarious. I mean, it was just like, I was just smiling really big. So then they wanted to take us to dinner afterwards. So they took us to this really authentic Chinese place, which was just down the street. And around the table sat all of these folks that were brokers and buyers of programming and all that. And they all wanted to see what I had brought with me. And so I met some really cool people, and I met the head of the station here in Los Angeles, the Chinese station, who we ended up having a meeting with. And you just don't get to meet with these people, guys. I have to tell you, this just doesn't happen. They're really difficult to meet with because they're so busy, and this is high-level stuff. So now they're examining the whole Watcher series. It takes 3 months for them to do that, and Chinese is an atheistic country, so
yes,
there can be nothing about religion or anything like that in anything that they do. But they do love UFOs, and they do love aliens and all that. And one of the Chinese kids came and said, "Man, I wish we had more UFOs in China." I said, "What are you talking about? You guys had this this massive one just a couple of years ago." I said, did you forget? And I said, he said, what? And I said, you had a UFO that basically shut down the Beijing airport. You guys remember that?
Yes, I do.
You guys remember
that?
And this gigantic ship shining a beam of light down at the tarmac was hanging over the runway, so they couldn't land planes. I mean, that's pretty insane. But that really happened. And so he was like, whoa, I had forgotten about that. So, you know, I said, yeah, you guys have UFOs too. And probably through some of my connections, I should probably call Stephen Bassett up and say, hey, what do you know about China, to help these guys out with that, to see if we can do a little more research. Maybe I need to go over to China again and visit some of these people and get an interpreter with me and see what experiences they've had, because I know they've had them. They just, this
mm-hmm.
crowd
oh, yeah.
with it. And I said, so how do you guys watch movies in China? I was just, I said, you know, because they couldn't play DVDs. And, of course, everybody here wants DVDs. All of people at like Watchers want DVDs, and DVDs are completely outdated, but everybody wants them anyway, so we continue to press them. Well, we also stream the, you know, Watchers, and we also, like with the Torah codes, I've also done Blu-ray of it so I could get HD. But I said, so what do you do in China to watch movies? He said, we watch it all streaming. I said, oh, okay, great. I said, how? And she said, we watch it on our cell phones.
Huh.
So people are watching movies in China on their cell phones. That's how they do it. I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, very.
The world's changing really, really quickly here. It's
a lot more
mobile. Of course,
they're
firewalled. You can't send an email to China. It's firewalled and won't go through. So they use like this little text machine. It's kind of like a Twitter, but it's not. It's something else that they use, and I can contact them through that if I need to. But I have other ways of getting to these folks beyond that. But I was presenting two new projects that I'm working on, and I haven't released this publicly yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I may just do it tonight if you guys don't mind.
Sure.
Yeah. I've been working on a project in Israel since the fall of 2015, and it has been very hush-hush, and it hasn't been something that I could really speak openly about. But it's basically, I've been given permission to explore the tunnels and cave system under the city of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Larry knows about this.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I can't really show you guys openly to your audience the piece that we produced about this, but essentially I have permission to work with the IAA, which is the Israel Antiquities Authority,
mm-hmm.
to go in and basically explore under the city of Jerusalem pretty much anywhere we want to and film it. And it's an expensive project. You can't just go in there with a few dollars and accomplish something like this. It's a four-episode series. It's going to be about a $2 million price tag to do this, because it also involves excavations and special equipment and really high-tech stuff where we're flying drones underground with the 3D mapping sensors on them.
Mm-hmm.
So we can actually map tunnels under the city of Jerusalem. And I said, so how do we shut off the no-fly zone so we can use our drones? He said, well, my friend there who is an archaeologist, and I won't name names because I'm going to keep everybody's anonymity here for the time being, but he said, I know the chief of police at Jerusalem really well, and we'll just tell him to turn it off for you guys. So basically, we can go in and do whatever we need to do. And what's really interesting is that there's several different aspects of archaeology that's going on in Israel right now. And I'm not an archaeologist. I always thought this was really long-haired, boring material. I really did. If an archaeological show comes on, you know, the television, I usually flip it off, because it's just like, you know, getting out there with camel hair brushes and looking for pottery shards is not what interests me at all. And they do that a lot, Israel, and they're like completely crazy about finding all of these weird little things, but they're also doing stuff that nobody knows about. Huge excavations that are so big you wouldn't believe it. There's at least 100 excavations going on in the state of Israel right now. And
incredible.
I think this is really important. I think it's important for them to establish that this is their homeland without a shadow of doubt.
Yes.
And the only way to do that is to find some of these really important artifacts. Now, they've already found a lot of stuff, and they've shown me things, but what I think would be the clincher is to actually find articles from Solomon's temple, things like that. So here's the story, and I don't know how much time we have or how much you want me to unfold all this, so I'll take a cue from you guys. Do you want me to continue?
Well, I did the show for an hour, and we'd like to get in, of course, into the Bible codes. But, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Essentially, there was a scroll found in Qumran. And Qumran is where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered.
Yes.
And
yes.
In 1952, they went in there and they found this scroll laying basically in the dirt on the floor of one of the caves, and it was made out of copper. And
yeah, the copper scroll.
Got,
yep.
It was, yeah, immediately called the copper scroll, and they didn't know what it was or anything like that. So they, you guys probably know about this, but your listeners may not. So I'm going to just quickly unfold what happened with this.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what to do with it, and it was corroded badly, and they couldn't bend it to unroll it and read it. So they sent it to London, where they had a forensic investigator use a razor saw and basically slice it into columns, because they could tell through the copper that it was written in columns. So they made a razor saw cut between each column of text. And it's like really super ancient Hebrew. It's at least 2,500 years old. And
wow.
It was like a very strange combination of Hebrew and Aramaic combined.
Huh.
So it took some time for them to essentially interpret it, translate it. I have the translation of it, and it reads like a treasure map for the most part. And I know that there's other guys that have worked on it. There's a man by the name of Jim Barfield that says he translated it. Well, that didn't go over very well with the IAA because they had translated it decades before. So, and I know because I've talked to the director general of the IAA. So, you know, the last thing I want to do is to go to Israel and insult anybody. You know, go in there and make it seem like I know something they don't, or, you know, that well, we have the answer to it, and you guys have been fooling around, or, you know, that's really insulting. So there's a certain protocol and respect that needs to be shown to these men that have been working underground, finding things for decades. And I'm interested in what they know, and I want to know what they know. And they know that, and they're really open with explaining what they've discovered. And there is a chain of events that has happened as a result of the Copper Scroll. There was a man by the name of Wendell Jones that the late 80s, Wendell Jones, some people say, is the real Indiana Jones. Well, he kind of got that reputation. Spielberg will probably tell you, no, it's really not how we arrived at the Indiana Jones name or anything like that. But, in fact, I have a team that I've already put together to work on this film, and one of them is Bob Williams, who I've mentioned to you guys before. He's a special effects expert out here in Hollywood. And during the month of March, he spent almost the entire month working with Steven Spielberg. So he has access to Spielberg, and Spielberg is the guy that did Raiders of the Lost Ark. So these projects that we're doing are near and dear to what he finds interesting too. And back in the late 80s, they thought they would start looking for some of the things that were listed in the Copper Scroll. And it wasn't just Wendell Jones. He had at least one or two other archaeologists working with him at the time. So they did a dig in Qumran at a cave that's not one of the touristy areas. It's like around the backside, close to the Dead Sea, and actually it's close to an IDF base and a kibbutz in the area as well. And I've been to this mountain more than once, and I flew drones over it, and I filmed it, and I've crawled inside the caves, and I mean, it's rather perilous actually getting into some of those caves because it's just like small pebbles, and you know, I'm not as sure-footed as I used to be in my old age here. So basically, I'm carrying a bunch of filming equipment or a drone or something like that, and my feet are slipping out from under me because of the surface of the ground is at an angle, and these stones are kind of like ball bearings, so it's hard getting up into them. But I walked into this cave where they had, in 1988, they had found, by looking in the Copper Scroll, the anointing oil. Now, they found this, they dug down into this cave, and they found this little juglet with a stopper in it, and it had been buried in this different colored earth that was lighter in color than the surrounding media. And that's how they knew they were getting really close. And the lighter color earth almost acted like silica gel to protect it. So it was almost like they knew enough about the chemical compounds of the rocks and the minerals in the area that they knew this had to be preserved. And when they opened the stopper on the oil, it was still full.
Wow.
I mean, consider that this is a juglet, a clay earthen vessel full of oil that's been buried for 2,500 years and hasn't lost anything.
Yeah, amazing.
I mean, just let that sink in for a moment.
Hand of the Lord.
So, it is. Now, the anointing oil was what was used on the high priest as he went in once a year into the Holy of Holies. So I'm trying to make this really trying to explain the importance of this. It's not just like, oh, we found a juglet of oil, cool. It's really, really important stuff. So then a few years later, they went back using the Copper Scroll again and thought they would try to find either the ashes of the red heifer or the incense. And the incense is known as the Ketoret. And they found another cave on the opposite side of the mountain. It had something like 30,000 tons of rock filling it up that someone had put in it.
Wow.
Now, this was a cave that the top of the cave is probably 20 feet tall. I've been in this cave too. And it was completely filled to the brim with rocks. Giant boulders, rocks, and everything. So that meant they had to excavate all of that out of there and kind of roll it down the mountain. So they had a conveyor belt. They got people in there with buckets, and they excavated it. And they came onto this slab of stone, and when they lifted it, it was completely sealed. They lifted it off, and it was completely full of the incense, of the Ketoret.
Wow.
All this red stuff. And when they first saw it, they thought it was the ashes of the red heifer because it was red. But then later they realized that it was actually the incense. Now, the incense was what the high priest used in the portable tabernacle, as you guys know, and people that have studied this would know. They would burn this. It was part of the process. And it had several different ingredients. It has four different kinds of cinnamon in it. And if the people that were making the incense initially left out one ingredient, they were to be put to death.
Wow.
So it was, the seriousness of this cannot be overstated. So what happened to all of these things, you ask me. It's very strange. Israel is a strange country. The juglet of anointing oil ended up in the museum in Jerusalem in a back room. It's not on display anywhere. The ketoret ended up under the care of Sarah Richards, who is Wendell Jones' daughter, who lives on the West Bank. And I spent all afternoon with Sarah the last time I was in Israel. And she walks out in the living room with this giant vessel. It's basically like a, like almost like a canning jar. It's really big. It's several liters tall, with one of those lids and a lever that you pull to snap it down. You know that what I'm talking about? Full of the ketoret stuff. And she said, you've got to taste it. Now, here's something that's been in the ground for 2,500 years, and she wants me to taste it. So I did. It immediately made my tongue go numb.
Wow.
And it has some sort of strange properties to it. It makes you feel flushed, and it's almost like has almost like a Novocaine kind of. I don't understand it. I mean, it has properties that need to be analyzed, and they had done some analysis on it before, but I need to do carbon-14 on it. If I can do that and determine its age for sure, then whether it's 2,500 or 3,000 years old, I think that would be important to have that documented. That's one of the things that I want to do when we get the funds to go into to doing this series.
Have they found the ashes yet?
No, but that's something that everybody's looking for. Currently, the state of Israel has started a mammoth project on searching the caves of Qumran. They invited us to join them, but there was just no funds for us to go over there yet to help. It's expensive to do this stuff. I mean, be over in Israel for 2 weeks, pay the people I need to pay, and bring camera equipment and do all that thing. I've spent like $11,000 in 10 days. And, you know, that's nothing. You know, it's just time.
Yeah, right.
And that doesn't even include airfare. So, you know, that's why we need large amounts of money to do this. And it's worth it, and it's incredibly interesting stuff. So the Qumran cave exploration, one of the guys that's heading up that process, his name is David Abraham. And they have a website and all that. You can find that on the web and look at what they're doing. But Israel is really doing a massive search of all the caves, because recently there was a cave in Qumran, Cave 53, and you guys have heard of Aaron Judkins, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron is an archaeologist. He's been to Peru twice with us, with LA and me. I like Aaron a lot. He's a smart guy. And so he went to help them excavate Cave 53, where they actually found a scroll that had never been found. And it was blank, unfortunately. But basically what they discovered was a cave where the guys had a business 2,000 years ago making these little scrolls and putting them into leather pouches and selling them. And that they discovered tools that they used and all of that. So they upgraded the number of that cave from Cave 53 to Cave 12. And so that generated new interest by the state of Israel to go back at what else is down there that we don't know. So they're doing this massive excavation now. They're trying to go through all of Qumran. Now, what is also interesting is that there is the City of David excavation, which if you've ever been to Israel, you've probably seen that. But I don't want to go to the touristy places. I wanted to go to the places where I'm not supposed to go. So they took me underground to this place where it's if you go to East Jerusalem, and you keep going east, you run into a little town called Silwan. And Silwan is actually shown in the Torah Code film, where these guys come out with machine guns when we were driving up the street. And
yeah.
Silwan is an interesting town. It's half Arab and half Jewish. And most of the time, they live side by side, no problem. But then you'll get like the oddball situation where there'll be some disgruntled Palestinian who wants to start throwing rocks on people's cars when they drive by. That happens up there. But under the edge of that city, underground, under the street level, is an excavation going on. And it's massive. They have like a conveyor belt system rigged into the ceiling with hooks and chain drive. And they have cloth fabric bags, and they scoop out dirt and they put it in a bag and they hang it over their head on this conveyor, and it's always moving constantly all day. And the conveyor goes all the way out, up through a hole in the ceiling, and a truck picks it up and dumps it. And then it goes to another place in Jerusalem where they wash all the dirt and they look for artifacts in all that silt. And they uncovered a walkway, and we were proud to say, this is the steps. And I mean, this is mostly Orthodox guys telling me this with a big smile on their face. These are the steps where Jesus walked. And I said, now, how can you guys possibly know that? And they said, because this is the only way he could have gotten from the Temple Mount to the Mount of Olives in those days. No other way existed. And the Romans buried it all in 70 AD. And they pulled up a piece of plywood off the floor and a piece of rubber and moved it back and said, check this out. And he points at this coin that was embedded into the floor because it just ended up there. It said 68 AD on it. It was a Roman coin. It was one of the last anything with any kind of dating to prove that that was the last thing that happened.
Wow.
So those steps have been buried since then. And have now they look completely new. If you walked on them, you'd go, well, it looks like you just poured this. It has curbs. It's got manhole covers. Now, the manhole covers are like, they're not like metal with, you know, like we have nowadays, but they are stone with square holes in them, and you can lift them up and crawl down under the ground. And when you do, you're in the Jerusalem flood control system of that era. And
wow.
It's big enough to stand up in. I've been in it. It's probably, I'm trying to estimate. It's probably 4.5 feet wide and maybe 5.5 feet tall. So it's kind of like long and slender. And it's all made out of stone, and it still exists, and it still works.
Wow.
And they're also checking that out under the Western Wall, under that whole area there. And they found similar structures, and I went down with them as they were chipping the dirt out of it, because it's a lot of it, you know, been impacted with dirt and rocks through the centuries. You know, Jerusalem's been buried and restored several times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, that's really what's going on there. So I told my archaeological friend there, I said, essentially, it's like we've got Jerusalem up on a lift and we're looking for missing suspension pieces. He said, exactly. So we're actually able to crawl around under the city and look for the way it was originally built, how it was built, where the water's supposed to flow, the whole deal. I mean, that's all coming to light now, all of that information, which I just think is really cool. That's more than just finding broken pieces of pottery. That's like we're learning how this whole city was constructed, and we're down crawling around under the city in tunnels and caves and checking it out. And to me, that's what the show I'm working on will be about. It's all of this incredible under the ground stuff. And maybe if we're really fortunate, we'll find something that's never been discovered. Yeah, that's
well, it sounds like what they're doing is finding essentials for the temple that's soon going to be built.
Well, this is what here. The whole story here is that back 500 and something BC, when Nebuchadnezzar came in, Jeremiah knew that this was going to happen. He could sense that Solomon's temple was going to be destroyed, and he had to get the most important articles of the temple out of there. Now, that would be things like the Ark of the Covenant, Table of Showbread, the ephod, things that were super critical, that were basically, you know, God helped them do. Now, I have my own theories about how some of that probably worked, because the ephod to me at this point, and Rabbi Glazerson and I have talked about this many times, and he sent me an article the other day where someone was comparing the ephod to an iPad, and I said, I don't think we're far off, really, from what it was. I really don't think that the ephod was, because it lit up, it answered questions, it had intelligence, it was like a little computer, and you weren't allowed to use metal cutting tools on it. Like, you couldn't chisel on it or anything. And of course, like, would you do that to an iPhone? Of course not, right? It would wreck it. That's why they would say stuff like that. So I know this sounds really crazy, and all Christian friends that are listening to me are going to think I'm completely insane, but I really think that we're talking about angelic / alien technology that was given to the children of Israel to use for specific purposes. And this stuff was good for a long time. We don't know what happened to it, except for the fact that during the Nebuchadnezzar disaster, Jeremiah had to hide all of this stuff. And the only thing that we can figure is, after going through some of these tunnels, there's something called the Zedekiah Cave area. And the Zedekiah Caves are basically under Solomon's Quarry. Now, if you guys have ever been to Jerusalem, there is a touristy spot called Solomon's Quarry, and it's got lighting underground, and you know, you pay a couple Arab guys some shekels, and they let you in, and basically you stay, you know, within the ropes, and you go around. And I've been there through all that, and you look up in the ceiling, and this is where they quarried all of the stones that built Solomon's temple. This is where they came from. And up in the ceiling are like these huge slots. I would say they're probably 2.5 inches wide, but they weren't allowed to use any chisels. That's like a mandate. So you go, well, how did they cut it? Well, it looks to me, when I looked at it, I said, you know, guys, this looks to me like they had a gigantic, like, grinding wheel, and this thing was like spinning, and they could just slice out huge chunks of this limestone. And at one time, I don't know if this is true, but the number that I heard is that they had 80,000 people working on this in its heyday, when they were building the temple and quarrying all of that stone. Well, underneath that level is a lower level that you're not supposed to go in, which I've been. And you have to crawl down through this tiny hole in the floor. It's like, you know, 2.5 feet wide, and it's pitch black. And first time they made me do this, I didn't bring any lights with me. I didn't know where they were taking me. And so we all turned on our cell phone lights. That's all the light we had. And we dropped down through a hole in the floor. So here I am, two levels underground in Jerusalem, walking around in the dark with a cell phone. You know, it's no way that we could look. But I wasn't about to let that stop me. And all of a sudden, you know, you're kind of all bent over and creeping along, and it's kind of slightly an incline. And then all of a sudden, it opens up into this vast room. And underneath there, it's like it's been hewn out. It's a gigantic cave system. And you come up to a wall that has two openings in it, and then you come up to an archway. Well, later I discovered that you guys have heard of a gentleman by the name who's now passed away, Ron Wyatt.
Oh, yes.
Ron Wyatt had done some excavation in that same spot where we were. Ron Wyatt has a deathbed confession that said in 1982 he discovered the Ark of the Covenant. Are you guys, have you heard his deathbed confession?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
So you guys know what I'm talking about. Your listeners may have not. But basically, he wove this whole story how he found the Ark of the Covenant. It was, he had to drop down through these various chambers that are underground there. And when he got in there, there were already three or four guys in the chamber with the Ark. And he basically intimated they were angels guarding it. Now, look, I don't know, okay? I don't know. But the kind of things that he said that the Ark was located under Golgotha. Now, that's what he said. Now, Golgotha is it's the hill where they would crucify people. In fact, there's still a hole in the ground where the cross was sunk in, from what I understand. Now, I haven't gone up there and looked at that yet, but I intend to next time I get to Israel. But he said that some of Christ's blood drained down through that hole, went down through cracks in the rock, and landed on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. And he had that blood tested, and it had a different number of chromosomes from human blood. Now, this is I'm just relating what he said, okay? It may be true, it may not be. I don't know, but the guy that I'm working with now, assuming we get our money fast enough, is the same archaeologist that worked with Ron Wyatt. So he knows every place Ron dug, and he knows where we could look next. So,
well, there is some verification on the blood, because they took some blood off the shroud and found it was different than normal human blood, too.
Well, I'm not certain about, because, I mean, there was like some hanky-panky going on around the shroud that you all know about. But they were trying, they basically were trying to pull C-14 off the shroud to prove that it wasn't as old as the time of Christ. And so they pulled fabric off of it from a spot that wasn't as old. But essentially, a lot of things can affect the carbon-14 dating. And if you remember right, and I won't go into this because this is another whole topic, but essentially the shroud at one time was folded up. It was put in a silver box. The church caught on fire. Part of the box melted in on the shroud and burned the corners off of it. Now, when that happened, that recharged the fabric so that it would get a different reading, because now it's been modified, if you know what I'm saying here.
Yes. Yep.
The fabric is different now because it's been burnt. So I don't know if we'll ever get an accurate figure off the shroud because of that, or if they just went in on it in another place that wouldn't affect the appearance of it and got a piece that they could carbon-14 date, that they could get a more accurate reading over it. But basically, they were paid like a £1 million grant to basically disprove it, according to the Right Honorable Barry Schwartz, who was there to photograph it back in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and plus, the weird thing, the city of Turin is a known center of occultism in Italy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I'm sure it is.
So, I mean, there's weird stuff going on there.
Yeah. What did you find out on the codes regarding Israel's immediate future? Because I know Glazison got very, very quiet for a long time, and we heard nothing from Bible codes, and all of a sudden they've started up again. Are they concerned about the future, immediate future of Israel? I noticed on one of the codes it had 2018, basically transliterated, but 2018 on one of the things. What do you know about that?
I mean, some of these tables I've seen so many tables, as you guys may have imagined. And Glazerson likes to try to date things if he can. And I understand what he's trying to do. And he does a lot of tables on Mashiach, saying that this could be the year of Mashiach's return. Mm-hmm. And yet he's done that now, really for the past 5 years. And it always comes up, Mashiach and the year, the current year that he's looking for. Now, I don't know why that is, except he does. I told him, I said, you know, we got to be careful about this because people are going to think that the codes are wrong. And so I think it's, you know, we got to be careful about that. So, you know, I wrote him a note about it fairly recently about that problem. And Professor Rips doesn't do that, and Art Levitt doesn't do it. It's just Glazerson. But Glazerson has said, well, throughout the centuries, rabbis have always predicted when the Mashiach would appear. I mean, this goes way back to, I guess, the Vilna Gaon, people like that, that were super mathematicians. But he said, I always preface it to say, if Israel repents. So he always has the word repentance. I said, yes, but I think what concerns me, and I love Glazerson dearly, so don't get me wrong here that we're having some kind of disagreement, because we're not. We just try to we try to make these things accurate. I said, people aren't going to understand that the word repentance could nullify the return of the Messiah unless you somehow explain that to them. Because even though that word is in there, that word repentance to Glazerson means that the Messiah is waiting until people are ready for him. That's what he believes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not sure that they'll ever be repentant enough if we went with that theory, but
yeah,
that's what he believes. So I'm not going to, certainly not going to argue with Glazerson about that particular issue, but he's done a lot of Mashiach tables, and he did one for 2016. In fact, 2016, I told him, I said, that was crazy, because that one, if any of them, really fooled me, because there was Gematria pointing to 2016, that it was supposed to be some incredible year for some sort of revelation of the Messiah. And so I was beginning to think that, well, maybe we're going to see the two witnesses, or maybe something's going to happen that year, and nothing happened. And yet there was like, oh, you guys remember, I put it in Watchers 9. There was like all of these lines of Gematria, you know, and it basically had one scripture at another, and they all added up to 776. I mean, it was just like crazy.
Yeah.
And yet it didn't happen. So it made me think, well, the Gematria is interesting, but it doesn't seem to prove out fundamentally with any solid information that we can actually say, well, this is going to happen because in the Gematria it says that. So, you know, mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, but now I don't put as much stock in it as I once did. And the only reason that I did was because there was so much of it, and it all ended up with the same number. And that seemed more than coincidence to me, if you guys know what I mean.
So are they concerned about the building the temple
yet? Well, they're concerned
yet,
about
or?
Iran. It's mostly Iran. And also, there's this thing going on with President Trump, where he's moving the embassy to Jerusalem in the month of May.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost imminent that that's going to happen. And in Israel, they're minting coins with Trump's head on it. And
yeah,
next to his head, next to his head is King Cyrus.
Yeah.
So they're comparing Trump to King Cyrus, which which in the tables that Liz and I put out a year ago, it said that. And now the rest of Israel is catching on to that idea, because there are a lot of strange parallels that I can't explain. I think one of the really interesting ones I have up on the Trump page on intodarkness.com, where it basically shows, it's Isaiah chapter 45, where it's all talking about Cyrus, and Trump is the 45th president.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it kind of tags them in a very strange way. And they, you know, and Cyrus was the one that brought them out of captivity and helped them rebuild the temple. And they kind of look at Trump as being a reincarnated Cyrus, so to speak. I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
But what they're
looking for
Trump
the return, however, sometime soon, I take it.
Yeah, they're trying to move this forward. Now, you know, I think all of these projects that we want to do and the stuff that they're doing now go hand in hand. We're just waiting on funds to get started, and we need a lot of it. And I'm working with several different brokers now to try to get this moving. I was just on a long phone call before I got on your show tonight, working on it some more. And so, you know, getting money is harder than it's ever been, and the networks are very resistant to showing anything about Israel now. So I'm not exactly sure how we're going to do it, but we're going to do it somehow, Lord willing.
Well, let me ask you something, Richard. You know, I know you've got all these projects planned. What is the recent data that you've got as far as a military clash pending between Iran and Israel? I know this seems to be almost imminent, even from what Mattis said yesterday about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you guys may have heard that Iran, and I don't know, how much more time do we have?
We only got a couple minutes.
Okay, so basically in a nutshell, just recently, Iran sent a militarized drone with ordnance on it across the northern border of Israel, and the IDF shot it down. That was something they've never done before. And then we had almost 30,000 Palestinians having an uprising on the Gaza Strip, and some of them tried to cross into Israel, and there was this battle that ensued. The next day, there were 20,000 there. They lost a lot of people. The next day, there was half that many people there, so it fizzled out. But then we think that some of the guys, I got a call from my friend David Bannister, who's a good friend. He lives on the West Bank. He said, Rick, I just want to tell you, they've called me out on patrol tonight because they think there's been an incursion of a terrorist in the Gaza Strip, and air raid sirens have gone off, and we're out looking for this guy tonight. So he was doing that, trying to find this guy, and they never did find a terrorist. But the intel was that there was somebody coming across, probably to blow themselves up or do some sort of damage. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. But meanwhile, Hamas is still building tunnels and doing all of that. And they're shooting rockets all the time in Israel. I have this app for my phone called Red Alert, and every time a rocket goes off, it beeps. And that's never in the news, and no one knows that's happening.
Yeah.
So
everything is censored here.
Yeah. And Netanyahu was concerned. He thought it was great that Trump bombed the chemical plants in Syria, but then he was afraid of how Iran might respond to that towards Israel. So that's where it sits right now, that it could be Iran could try to do something, and Trump doesn't want to do another deal with Iran. Or, you know, they haven't kept the original deal. So really the original deal, I don't know. It's just a piece of paper. They're not really adhering to it. It was something Obama and Kerry did, and it was ridiculous, and it hasn't worked. And Iran's never going to honor agreement.
Yeah.
And there's
okay. Well, I guess we're going to have to close down. Can you give quickly your website again?
Oh, sure. Yeah, and sorry to go over. It's pinlight.com, PINLIGHT.com.
Okay.
And
all
that
right.
will get you pretty much everything.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Richard, for coming on. And thank you, Larry. Good night, everyone.
Good night.